Welcome back. So yesterday we finished by discussing what we expect to happen in the early universe. If you have a scalar field, just for the moment, a free scalar field with a mass m. So we argued that most probably in the far past, our universe underwent a phase of exponential expansion called inflation. And during this phase, any field configuration of any kind in space is expected to undergo an exponential stretch. Every gradient will flatten out. And as a result of that, in any observable patch of the universe, the field will appear homogeneous, which means a constant in space. But the value of the constant will differ depending on which patch of the universe you look at. And then the universe will evolve further, so if you expect the time to flow this way, the universe will evolve further with this in each patch of the universe with this different initial condition. And eventually, we arrive to today, where we'll see only a small portion of the full universe, which are in causal contact with us. And so we'll experience only a particular value of the field, which will be different in different parts of the universe, which are still causally disconnected today. So the actual value of the field that we will experience, we will set the initial condition for how portions of the universe is uncalculable. It's just a property that we cannot best measure, okay, locally. Similarly to, if you want, the local abundance of dark matter in our galaxy, if we were not able to see through the boundary of the galaxy to the rest of the universe. We only experience the local value around us. All right, so, however, because of this, our equation of motion simplifies enormously because the field equation for our field now become approximately just ordinary differential equation. All the gradients are zero. So our scalar field phi will only depend on time. So will only be the part of the field equation that depends on time. So we have a phi double dot plus 3h phi dot, the friction term, plus the mass term. The gradient part basically exponentially went to zero. So now all we had to do is just to solve this ordinary differential equation that is function of time for the field everywhere in space, homogeneously. So you can notice that this equation now boiled down to just the equation for a damped harmonic oscillator with frequency set by the mass, m, and friction, which is the Hubble scale. So what's Hubble scale doing? So the Hubble scale basically measures the energy density of the universe. During this inflationary regime, H was constant, let's say H naught. At the end of inflation, some other energy density start dominating the universe. It could be matter, it could be radiation. In both cases, H is expected to decrease as a power of time. So H during this phase is expected to be proportional to 1 over T. This is the scaling laws we saw last time. So in the whole discussion here, I'm assuming that Hubble during inflation is parametrically larger than the mass of our field. After all, we're interested in masses that are very small, below EV, maybe 10 to the minus 10 EV, and Hubble during inflation most probably is at some macroscopic scale, GV or above. So this means that the mass will basically be around here. So at early times, Hubble scale will be larger than the mass, but eventually it will go down. Okay. This means that at early time, the friction wins. So you have overdamped harmonic oscillator. But at late time, the field is expected to start oscillating when basically H becomes of order M. Notice that H is parametrically of order 1 over T. So this means that you'll have this transition when the age of the universe is roughly the inverse of the mass of your particle. All right? Okay, so we'll expect basically the following. So we have phi here as a function of time and time. So in the first interval of time for times smaller than the inverse mass, means Hubble larger than M, the field is approximately constant, as we will see, but then eventually it will start oscillating, and you'll have oscillations that decreases in time due to the friction term. So if you look at the scalar potential for the field, so this is B of phi, which in this case is just half m squared phi squared, the energy density stored in the value of the field. You will start around some value of phi equal to phi naught, which is a particular value in the universe we are looking at. At early time, you'll be stuck here because of friction, but eventually, at late time, the field will start oscillating around the minimum, relaxing around the minimum. With oscillations, it will be damped, okay? It will be smaller and smaller with time. So let's now be a little bit more quantitative. So we want to solve this equation, except that now this Hubble, this friction term is also time dependent. So remember that Hubble is by definition the rate of expansion of the universe, so it's the scale factor dot over A. So we're going to look for an explicit solution to this equation. At early time, the solution is basically just the solution to an equation without M. H is much larger than M, you can neglect this term. So the general solution for this equation is just phi equal to constant. Instead, at late time, M will start dominating. So at times where H is smaller than M, you can make the following approximation. So first, let me replace phi. Let me write phi of t as psi of t over a to the 3/2. So this is a rescaling of the field by the scale factor, which will simplify this equation further. So let's just take this field definition. I call phi psi over 8 cube, and I substitute inside this equation, and I get an equation for psi. So you can do this as an exercise. The equation for psi you get is psi double dot, the first term, and then I chose this factor here in such a way that the term linear in time derivative simplifies away. So you only get the following term, the mass square terms, and then terms that are derivative of Hubble or the Hubble square term. So now it looks like a harmonic oscillator type equation. At late time when H is small, so these terms goes like 1 over T squared. Also this term will go like 1 over T squared. So at late time, this term goes to zero, where in particular, it will become small with respect to m. So the approximate solution for this equation is just psi equal to some constant times cosine of mt plus small correction due that goes to zero as h goes to zero. So now I can replace this solution inside here, get the full solution for phi at late time. So phi of t will be some initial value phi naught. Some factor goes like a to the 3/2 of time. Let me add a prefactor here with a star to the 3/2 cosine of mt. And this is basically the approximate solution for a late time, for Hubble much less than the mass. So as promised, you have oscillations with frequency of order m, and amplitude that decreases with time with some powers of the scale factor. I chose this prefactor A star such a way that let me call T star the time at which H of T star is equal to M. So this is basically this time here. So before this time, the field was constant, equal to phi naught. After this time, H becomes small, and basically the field starts oscillating. So I set roughly the initial condition at T equal to T star, this factor is 1, and you get the amplitude which matches the initial value of phi naught. And then the field will start oscillating and be damped. As usual, feel free to interrupt and ask questions. Okay? All right. Okay, so now we have basically the evolution of the field. So we can compute various things. In particular, we want to compute what is the abundance of the field today. What is the abundance in energy density in this field? So we're interested in the average energy density. I'm averaging over time interval which are parametrically larger than 1 over m, so that this oscillation averages out. So the average rho, we actually had the formula yesterday, is just 1/2 the frequency squared. The frequency here is just the mass, m squared, times the amplitude of the field squared. And the amplitude of the field is just, as a function of time, it's just this factor here. So we get phi naught squared times A star over A as a function of time to the power 3. So now you see that the energy density is varying with time as the inverse, the cubic power inverse of the scale factor. And if you remember what we saw yesterday, this is the scaling law for non-relativistic matter. If you have non-relativistic matter, you expect that the energy density just decreases as the volume increases with the inverse volume power, so it's 1 over A cubed. So indeed, the matching, the energy density of this scalar field is behaving exactly like a non-relativistic fluid. And this should not be surprising since this field configuration is completely homogeneous. So it's a constant in space. Any gradient is zero. So if you have a field, a classical field with no gradients, it will correspond to a gas of particles with no momentum at rest. And because of this, it is forced basically to reshift like non-relativistic matter. Okay. Equivalently, the number density will be the energy density per unit divided by the mass, the energy of each particle, so it will be rho over m, and this is basically 1/2 m phi naught squared A star over A cube. Okay, so eventually we want to compute how much is the energy density or the number density today. So we have to compute this object here at the scale factor of today. So let me do this in the following way. Let me erase. Maybe I can still write here. So, or no. Let me get more space. So eventually you want to see for which values of the masses and the initial amplitude of the field we get an abundance which is could be compatible with what we see today for dark matter. So let's compute omega phi, which is just the ratio between the energy density in the phi field over the total energy density in the universe. So let me write this in the following way. Let me divide and multiply by the energy density of the photon today, or at any time, t. And this object here, this ratio here is known, is the fraction of energy density in photons, which today is measured to be around 10 to minus 5. And so to compute omega phi, we had to basically compute the relative energy density between phi and the photons. So this is equal to, in the numerator, I just report that function there, 1 half m square phi naught square a star over a cube. And the denominator, I had to divide by the energy density of photons. So the photons, today they behave like a black body. They have a black body spectrum associated to some temperature. This is the temperature of the CMB today, which is of order 10 to minus 4 eV. This is 2 Kelvin. So the energy density in the photon up to some order 1 coefficient is temperature of the photon to the 4. So now start dropping and go to supernatural units and start dropping order 1 coefficient. I only want to show you the scaling with the relevant parameters. And then I will restore all the factors at the end to get the actual number. All right, so basically this is of order m squared phi naught squared divided by t photon to the 4. Oh, there was a omega gamma, which I forgot. And then there is this factor A star over A. Now, to compute this factor A star over A, we notice the following, that so there is a relation that I didn't discuss yesterday between the entropy density in the universe and the scale factor, which says that the product of these two things is a constant in time, if there is no particle production. So the entropy density is basically the total number of particles per unit volume. It's similar to the number density, but now summing over all species that are relativistic, basically, at that time. So it's something that have some factor of order 1 times the temperature cube, if you have a relativistic species. Otherwise, contribution will be highly suppressed by Boltzmann factors. It basically counts the number of relativistic degrees of freedom in the universe. So this relation just tells you that the temperature basically is reshifting, or relativistic particle is reshifting like the inverse power of A, of the scale factor, which is associated to the fact that wavelengths basically get stretched as the universe expands with the scale factor. So the temperature basically decreases like 1 over A. So you see that now if I take the ratio between this object with itself at different time, I get a relation between the ratio of A cubes at different time related to the ratio of temperature cube at different time. So this ratio of A star over A cube is also the ratio of T over T star cube. So you get basically the damping of this amplitude goes like the the decrease in the temperature of the universe cube. So this is the temperature today, which is the temperature of photon, roughly. And this is the temperature at the time t star. So this is the temperature of the universe when this field starts oscillating. So to finish the calculation, we have to determine the temperature, what was the temperature of the universe when the field starts oscillating. So to do that, so we assume that when the universe will start oscillating, the energy density was dominated by radiation, like it has been for the standard model in the past. So here I had to use a relation from Einstein equation, which tells me that the Hubble, the energy density stored in the curvature, which is m Planck squared times the size of the universe, the inverse size of the universe squared, is basically related to the energy density of the universe. And the energy density in the universe is proportional if you have like a radiation domination. So if you are dominated by radiation, it's expected to be by just a black body distribution proportional to the temperature of the universe to the fourth power. Well, for the same reason that today the energy density of the photon scales like t to the fourth. So this relates t star, the temperature where the axion start, this field starts oscillating, with the Hubble scale at that time. But you remember that the time was defined as the time where the Hubble scale was equal to the mass. So you can rewrite the temperature T stars in terms of the mass of the particle and Planck. So roughly, up to factors of order 1, T star square is equal to m times m Planck. So now we can replace these relations inside there. And we get what? We get that our omega phi is roughly omega gamma m squared phi naught square. T gamma to the 4, T gamma cube, give just a T gamma in the denominator. And T star cube from here, just give a factor which is m to the 3/2, m Planck to the 3/2. So we get the relation that omega phi is roughly omega gamma m to the 1/2 phi naught square divided by t gamma m Planck to the 3/2. So this omega gamma, I repeat, is of order 10 to minus 5. This temperature here is of order 10 to the minus 4 eV. So if you plug all the numbers in, you'll get that this object is of order 0.1 or 0.2 times the mass. For the mass, basically of order 10 to the minus 22 eV to the power 1/2, and phi naught of order 10 to the 17 GeV to the power 2. Just to replace it. And then Planck, of course, in EV was 10 to the 27 EV, roughly. So you see that the energy density in this field is compatible with what we see for dark matter, order 0.1, 0.2, If, for example, the mass of this particle is of order 10 to minus 22 eV, which is the lowest bound for the dark matter particle, when phi naught, when the initial misalignment of the field with respect to the minimum, it's of order 10 to the 17 GeV, so it's close to M Planck, a little bit less. Of course, we don't know what's the right value for phi naught is. It's a free parameter. So for smaller value of phi naught, you can get agreement with dark matter for larger masses. So this formula only tells you that you can have, you can explain dark matter from this field for a wide range of masses, as long as you are allowed to change the initial misalignment value of phi naught, which means that you look at the bigger universe and you choose the patch of that universe in which the field at the beginning was displaced by a certain amount from its minimum. So there will be different patches of the universe which are outside our causal, outside our observable one, which will have a different amount of dark matter, depending on the different values of phi naught. But you see that there will always be a patch with the right dark matter abundance that we see for a wide range of masses. So we can have masses that range from 10 to the minus 22 all the way to 10 to minus, well, 10 to the 2, what was 25 eV, 10 to the 1 eV. If phi naught is varied between 10 to the 17, let's say 10 to the 17 in this case, down to, you see that phi naught goes like the second power and m to the 1/2 power. So you can, every 4 powers of masses, you just need to change 1 power of pi. So here it will be like 20, 22 powers over 4 is roughly 5. So this is like 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12 here. So basically for the whole spectrum of that we were interested in, of masses below EV, all the way down to 10 to the minus 22, it could in principle, dark matter could in principle be explained in this way, with this misalignment mechanism. Just a scalar field with a tiny mass and a big displacement. Yes.
Why are you choosing to pull out the 0.1 on the second line?
Sorry, why I'm...
The coefficient line on that, the 0.1. I'm assuming that's the 0.1. The 0.1, what is that?
Oh, prefacto. I just replaced all these numbers in, so maybe this will be better. So this is the amount of dark matter we see. And is reproduced if the mass is this value and phi naught is this value, or if you change, if you increase m and you decrease phi naught such that this product is constant, you still reproduce the right amount of the matter.
And where are you getting the 10 to the 17 giga electron volts?
Oh, it's mostly due to this M Planck to the 3/2. So if you want, let me do one step more. I have omega gamma here. I can write this in the following way. M over T gamma square over M Planck to the 1/2 phi naught over M Planck square. Okay? So M Planck is 10 to the minus, is 10 to the 10 to the 27 eV, which is roughly 10 to the 18 GeV. So almost 10 to the 17 here. It appears here. And T gamma square over M Planck is close to this number here. Well, there is a 10 to the minus 5, so I had to reabsorb part of this 10 to the minus 5 in this factor here and can match this number there.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. All right, so you see that basically this mechanism can account for all the dark matter that we see for in the whole range of light bosonic dark matter, where the dark matter will behave as a classical field. So this is the simplest dark matter model I can think of. And however, as it is now in its minimal form, it's also the nightmare scenario, because this is just a free scalar field, which only couple gravitationally to us. Its gravitational interaction we already observed by the observation of dark matter gravitationally, and there will be no other sign of this field. Fortunately, in more realistic scenario, you will expect this field to eventually couple to us as well. And in those cases, you basically get a relation between the displacement. Typically, you can get some loose connection between this displacement here and the expected coupling of this field to us. And this is what I'm going to discuss further in this lecture. One important, however, observation that we have to make for this kind of models is that it shows that even if the original displacement was smaller than what was required, or the mass was smaller, you always expect a irreducible contribution of this field to dark matter. So even if you have a model, a different model of dark matter, like WIMPs or any other production of dark matter, and most of the dark matter is accounted for by this other type of particle, if you have a scalar field in your theory, a light scalar field, which was there during inflation, which means that it's not a composite particle with a scale of compositeness below the Hubble scale, but it's a fundamental scalar field that is there also at high energies, then you will expect that at least part of the dark matter we see today is in the form of this scalar field. Just because you don't expect that the scalar field itself starts exactly at the minimum during inflation. During inflation, you have scales much larger than the mass. The field will not even know about its mass. So you will not expect that the initial values of the field knows where the minimum is. So you always expect this phi naught to be different from zero. And for this reason, you will expect some energy density of dark matter being the form of the scalar field. So even if one day dark matter will be discovered like from a WIMP experiment, it's still important to look for other forms of sub-component of dark matter if you have reason to believe that you have some light scalar field, elementary scalar field in your theory. Like, for example, for QCD axiom.
Can you talk a little bit about the natural value of phi naught? Is there, if there is such a thing?
Yeah, now I'll move on to more realistic models, and I will comment on that.
Thank you.
Any more questions about this point? Okay. So, as I said, in this model, there is not much you can hope to see except for this dark matter gravitationally coupled to us. There's only one potential bound, which, however, not that strong, in this model that come from what are called isocurvature fluctuations. So I said that at the classical level, because of inflation, the field was stretched and there was no gradient of the field. This is not completely true at the quantum level, because at the quantum level, you always have quantum fluctuations of the field. So different Hubble patches during inflation, which are causally disconnected, they will have quantum fluctuations which are uncorrelated, and therefore they will be different in each patch. So this quantum fluctuation basically is like introducing a noise on the values of the field, phi. And you can estimate these quantum fluctuations of the field to be related to the Hubble scale, which is basically set by the volume of the universe during inflation, which is the Hubble scale. So basically, you can understand this as the quantum fluctuation for the zero mode of the field. The zero mode is the field is like a massless particle in a box. The box is the size of the universe during inflation, which is H. So by just uncertainty principle, you expect that the values of phi will vary by an amount which is basically set by the size of your box, which is the inverse H. So this means that there will be small gradients. After inflation, different patches will re-enter the horizon, and you will start seeing that the field was not equal to phi naught, exactly phi naught everywhere, but it will be phi naught plus this delta phi, which is of order H. So this means that in our picture here, if this was the potential for phi, and this was our phi naught, the actual value, the initial value for phi, instead of being phi naught everywhere, it will be phi naught plus delta phi with fluctuations of order Hubble in different Hubble patches. So if Hubble is small compared to phi naught, this fluctuation will be small. And so if you have a fluctuations of order Hubble, this means that different Hubble patches will have a slightly different misalignment condition. So it will lead to slightly different abundances of dark matter. So it will create spatial inhomogeneities of the dark matter abundance, which is controlled by the scale of Hubble during inflation. Now, there are experimental constraints on the size of these inhomogeneities in the dark matter in the dark matter spectrum. This is from the CMB. So these inhomogeneities, delta omega over omega, are bound to be roughly 10 to the minus 2 smaller than the usual inhomogeneities in the CMB, which are the fluctuations, the temperature of the CMB, which are already very small, of order 10 to the minus 9. So this means that this inhomogeneities that are called isocurvature fluctuations must be very small, 10 orders of magnitude smaller than 1, which means that this fluctuation H must be, with respect to phi naught, must be smaller than the square root of this, or 10 to minus 5 or so. So this gives a bound on the scale of inflation given a particular value of phi naught, which must be 5 orders of magnitude or more less than this scale. So if you'll find in the future dark matter of this kind, from the value of the mass, you might reconstruct what is the initial displacements, and then you could argue that given the initial displacement, you get a bound from the scale of inflation is from basically the smallness of this isocurvature fluctuation. So these scenarios are, in general, incompatible with high-scale inflation, with the scale of inflation that's as high to produce, for example, primordial gravitational waves. So the observation of primordial gravitational waves exclude this type of dark matter, at least in its minimal form that I discussed here. Okay? Yes.
So how are these CMB fluctuations related to the fluctuations in the dark matter densities? Are we assuming some kind of interaction between phi and gamma here?
Phi
and the CMB.
No. So the CMB fluctuations, they're called adiabatic. These fluctuations, you can imagine as being fluctuation of the metric itself. So it will be fluctuation in all type of species, relativistic, non-relativistic.
Oh, so it's the isocurvature.
This isocurvature instead of just fluctuations of the dark matter. So you can distinguish the two by comparing the fluctuations of the dark matter field with respect to the radiation field.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
So the delta omega, so the inhomogeneities of the dark matter is in time or is space?
You mean these fluctuations here?
Yes.
Yeah, these fluctuations here, it's a gauge-dependent question, but you can imagine them to be fluctuations in space. So different Hubble patches that on the same time surface, different Hubble patches that are causally disconnected will quantum fluctuate in a different way, which means that these are isocurvature fluctuations, so they don't change the metric, they only change the curvature, they only change the value of the field, which is in this approximation is massless, so it doesn't directly act on the metric. So it just changed the value of the field in space.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right. Okay, so now let me move on to some more realistic scenario. Time. So far I just assume that you have a scalar field, very light, which is elementary all the way to very high energy, possibly the Planck scale. However, more realistic scenarios where field in general will have interactions with at least other particles, you'll expect that the smallness of the mass of this particle, of this scalar field, must be associated, must be protected by some symmetry. And this basically leads to associate this kind of particle to a Goldstone boson. So you need basically this field phi to enjoy a shift symmetry, an approximate shift symmetry, such that it protects the mass from large quantum fluctuation due to the interactions. This corresponds to basically require that you have a symmetry that is spontaneously broken by the value of the field itself. And generically, this corresponds to basically associate this scalar field to a Goldstone boson of a spontaneously broken U1 symmetry. So you have a symmetry. The simplest case you can think of is an abelian U1 global symmetry, which is spontaneously broken. The spontaneous broken of this symmetry lead to a Goldstone boson that you can imagine as being the phase of the phase rotation associated to the U1. And because it's a Goldstone boson, its mass, it's either zero or very small if you have a small breaking of the Goldstone boson. You may imagine the usual maximum ahead potential where you have a U1 symmetry associated to rotations. And the vacuum of the theory, the low lying state, is degenerate. And the position of the valley is parameterized by the value of the field itself. MV is a dimension full scale that basically sets the scale at which this symmetry can be restored. So you can think of this as a toy model, for example, for superfluids, where you have a phase transition in which basically a U1 symmetry is spontaneously broken. In that case, the U1 symmary is associated to baryon number, for example. It's the condensation of some atoms. Okay, so in this type of model, basically, the phi field parameterizes an angular variable, phi over v. So in this case, it's the range of this phi field is finite. The phi field is compact, okay? It's like an angle. So which means that phi of x is bound to be, for example, minus pi v to pi v. Any breaking of this rotation symmetry can be very small in a natural way. For example, you can think that you have some extra breaking of the symmetry that tilts this potential a little bit and produce now a non-trivial potential for the scalar field, in the sense that the energy of the field depends on the position in this valley. Of course, because this variable now is compact, any such potential will be periodic in phi. So any potential for the scalar field, V of phi, will be such that V of phi plus 2 pi V, the potential will be the same. So in this case, you'll get typically potentials of this kind. For example, cosines or any periodic function of phi. So if phi is small, the displacement of phi from the minimum is small, you can approximate this potential with just m squared phi squared, like I did before. But when phi becomes of order the symmetry breaking scale, the potential will become nonlinear, will get higher terms, higher powers of terms that basically will eventually make the potential periodic. And this will account for self-interaction of the phi field with itself, basically. You'll get phi to the 4, phi to the 6 terms, and so on. But for small displacement, the potential is approximately m squared phi squared. Now, this scale V also controls basically the way phi couples to other fields. Because of the symmetry, the field will always enter as a phase. So, and then if you expand this phase, you'll get the usual coupling to matter. So the most general coupling to matter you can think of would be of the form of phi of x over v times some operator of the standard model. So this operator of the standard model could be ff tilde, gg tilde, on. You can couple to photons, to gluons. So this is basically the kind of couplings you saw yesterday in the yesterday talk. Or you could have derivative couplings that don't break the shift symmetry of this kind, d mu phi over b times some vector current in the standard model, made of fermions, and so on. These are all allowed couplings by the symmetry. As you see, all the couplings are controlled by the inverse powers of this scale V, which also set the largest range of change of the phi field. Okay, for among all these possible type of fields, Goldstone bosons that are usually called the axion-like particle, ARCs, one particular one is the is the axion, the QCD axion, which is the one that is theoretically most motivated because it's the one that also solves another conundrum of the standard model, which I don't know if will be discussed tomorrow, which is the strong CP problem. So if you have a field of this kind that couple to, in particular, to QCD, to GG tilde, and the largest breaking of its shift symmetry, of its potential, is determined by this coupling itself, then this field could solve the strong CP problem, which, okay, maybe you can ask tomorrow to Jesse. So the coupling to QCD in this particular case also produce a non-trivial potential for the axiom field. So this potential is periodic. Maybe I don't write the explicit form, but its height is basically set by lambda QCD to the fourth power by non-perturbative QCD effects. And its extent is of order V. So, well, let me, well, I don't know if I want to write it, let me write it in a very approximate form I don't like, but. Of this kind. The mass of the axion is parametrically, by expanding this cosine along the minimum, you'll get basically phi squared over V squared. So the quadratic terms is of order lambda to the 4 over V squared. And then you have higher order terms as you expand along the minimum. Sorry, this is the mass. And the potential will be then M squared phi squared plus higher order terms. So you see that there is a one-to-one correspondence between this scale V and the mass of the axiom field. But the scale V is also what sets the coupling of this field to the standard model. So the coupling will be proportional to 1 over V, but the mass is also proportional to 1 over V. So basically, the coupling in this model are proportional to the mass. The smaller the mass, the less is the coupling of the particle to us.
Left the phi squared in the mass.
I forgot what?
Squared equal lambda to the fourth over V squared.
Sorry, there is no phi squared. Thanks. Okay. So if you're only for the part of the universe, for the discussion I did before, that only displays by an amount phi naught, which is smaller than V, you can approximate the potential with m squared phi squared. And the discussion I made before for the abundance will be very similar. However, for the actual, this is true for ALPS. For the QCD axiom, there is a further complication. And the further complication is that this prefactor of the potential is actually temperature dependent. So at early universe, the temperature of the universe was much smaller. And because of that, the QCD effects will be suppressed. Now, the most recent estimates for the temperature dependence of this QCD potential, QCD contribution to the mass of the axion seems to suggest that the mass as a function of the temperature basically scale with the temperature roughly as, so the mass at zero temperature, Tc over T to the fourth power, roughly. Where Tc is basically the temperature where the QCD has a transition, which is roughly 0.1 GeV. More or less when QCD confines. So a temperature larger than the confinement transition above the GeV, the mass of the QCD axion is suppressed by powers of the temperature. When the temperature reaches Tc, the mass of the axion saturates to its zero temperature value. So in our history of the universe we met before, where the Hubble scale during inflation then decreases, as a function of time. We have to add also the non-trivial time dependence of the mass of the axion. So before we assumed that the mass of the mass of the phi particle was constant. Now it's no longer true. At early time, the temperature is large, so the mass of the axion will be small, and it will grow as the temperature of the universe cools down until it reaches its final value. So it will be more like this. So at the time when Hubble matches the mass and the axion will start oscillating, the value of the axion mass is still smaller than the value of the axion today. And this will affect a little bit the calculation of the abundance that we made before. So now I don't know if I have enough. How much time I have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. So I will not be able to probably go through the whole derivation, but I can maybe sketch roughly or just tell you the final result. Most important. So basically, you remember that our energy density is expected to be 1/2 m squared times the displacement of the field square. And then there was a dilution factor with the scale factor. Now this mass here is no longer the mass at zero temperature, but it's the mass at a particular temperature, m star. So the number density, which is conserved, will be this value. And the final number, the final energy density will be, therefore, the mass of the axion at zero temperature times this number density. So I will not go through the whole derivation, but you can repeat all the steps we did before. But now with the extra requirement that when you match H to determine the temperature at which the axion starts oscillating, you have to use the fact that the mass of the axion is changing with the temperature with this high temperature. So if you perform all the steps, you can show that the final abundance of the axion matches the observed one. 2.5, 2.6, whatever. For FA or V of the axion, 10 to the 12 EV to the power 7 over 6 times theta naught square. So V is the period of the full extent of your field, but your abundance will depend on the initial value of phi naught. Let me write phi naught, the initial displacement, as some angle theta naught times b. So I can basically consider phi over v, I can call it theta, because it ranges between minus pi and pi. And the initial displacement is this value of theta naught. So if you write it in terms of the initial displacement between 0 and pi, the final abundance will scale in this way. Here there is this funny power 7 over 6. This funny power comes from when you match H with M, since now there is this power to the T over the 4. You'll find that T, instead of T cube of the previous case equal to M times M Planck, you'll find T to the 6. That then when you invert, it give you 1/6, and then at the end, it'll give you an extra 1/6 power here. So you see that in this scenario, you get the right dark matter abundance for values of the decay constant, roughly of order 10 to 12 GeV, for the case in which the initial displacement is of order one from the whole range. So if the initial displacement theta naught is of order one with respect to V, you get the right abundance when V is of order 10 to 12 GeV. But as we said before, different Hubble patches will experience a different displacement. So there will be also Hubble patches which initial, with initial condition with theta closer to the minimum. In this case, theta naught will be smaller, and you'll get agreement for larger values of the decay constant of V. And you also get cases in which theta naught is very close to the top. In this case, our formula before were not valid, because now you cannot neglect the fact that the potential is not just an harmonic oscillator, square phi square, you get no linearities. So what it happens here is that if you start close to the top, the field will take longer to roll down because the gradient is smaller. This means that the dissociations of the scalar field will start later. And if they start later, there will be less redshift. So you get even more dark matter abundance. So you can, after you take all this into account, you find that the right dark matter abundance can be explained for the QCD axiom in the whole range, through misalignment in the whole range for V that goes from roughly 3 10 to the 9 GeV when the displacement theta naught is very close to pi, to the top of the potential, all the way to basically in Planck 10 to the 17, 10 to the 18 GeV, wherever you want to stop. If the original misalignment is instead very close to the origin of order theta naught over the minus 2 or minus 3. As I said, also in this case, we have no control of what is the original value, or the initial value for the displacement. It's just a environmental property of where we happen to live in the bigger universe. So all you can do is just to measure it. Okay, so my last plot to summarize. So you can now try to plot, and this is probably what you see often in the literature, plots that are more relevant for experiment, where you can plot the range of masses that we discussed so far and the expected coupling G to matter, which scales with the inverse values of V. Okay? So let's say this is 10 to the minus 1 EV. This is 10 to the minus 22 EV. Now, I have to manage to make a meaningful plot. So you remember that in the ALP case, the abundance scales like m to the 1 half times, let's say, V squared times the misalignment square. So you see that coupling is proportional to the mass in this type of models. So you see that, coupling goes like 1 over V. It's proportional to the mass only in the QCD case, QCD axiom case. In general, the coupling goes like 1 over V. So if you fix this omega to be the dark matter, you find that this is true when the basically coupling G, it scales like m to the 1 quarter. So the right dark matter abundance will probably be, will lie on in a log plot on this line here of coupling versus masses. If you assume that the original misalignment is of order 1. And just this values will be basically the inverse of the 10 to the 17 GeV. And this will be the inverse of 10 to the minus whatever, 11 GV. Sorry, yes. 1 over 10 to the 11 GV. Of course, if you can displace by an amount which is different from V by just playing with this theta naught, so if you take larger displacement, you go up. If you get smaller displacement, you can go arbitrarily down. So all this region of parameter space could explain the Rydberg matter abundance. For the QCD axion, you get also a constraint between the mass and the coupling. So in that case, you get something that does like this, using the other formula there, where this is roughly 10 to the minus 11 EV, and this is roughly 10 to the minus 2 EV or so. For displacement, again, theta naught of order pi, theta naught of order 1 is around here, and theta naught of order 10 to the minus 3. So if you want, the take-home message from this type of plot is that in principle, you should look for dark matter everywhere. These lines here basically correspond to the benchmark region where you should expect, you might expect, start seeing this type of scalar field if they are dark matter, even if they are only part of the dark matter. If you want, you should see these lines here as benchmark points where you want to reach in sensitivity in the coupling of your experiments to be to start being sensitive to this form of dark matter. Of course, there is no guarantee that you'll find dark matter even if it's there with that mass, because the original misalignment could have been smaller, and then you have to dig more and more. The final, maybe one final comment is that because there is most of the experiment looking for dark matter, actually they are not just sensitive to the coupling but also to the dark matter abundance. They typically, their sensitivity scales like as the coupling of phi to the standard model times the square root of the dark matter abundance. Now, the dark matter abundance is usually in this plot assumed to be the observed one, so you get just the coupling, basically a plot in the coupling. But in the actual experiment, you don't know if that form of dark matter is the whole dark matter or not. But what you know that for fixed mass, for each bin of this parameter, the actual energy density of dark matter scales like, well, there is a function of the mass, but then it will be the original displacement or V square, which is 1 over the coupling. So you see that the dependence on the coupling simplifies away. So you can see this threshold in sensitivity also as valid threshold of sensitivity in the case that particle is not the whole dark matter, but it's only part of it. So it could have been that particle is less than the observed dark matter, but its coupling is larger, so you're still sensitive to it if you reach that type of sensitivity. And another observation from this plot is that despite as you move in this region, the effective coupling is supposed to decrease. This is not true for the sensitivity because in this case, the number density of the field also increases. So in order to explain dark matter, you have to have more dark matter particle, and this compensates for the smaller coupling. And this is the reason why looking for dark matter is a meaningful endeavor also in this region, because despite the fact that the coupling is very small, you are rewarded by a larger energy density, because the mass is smaller, so you need much more particles, much larger occupation numbers to explain dark matter, and this compensates for the smallness of the cap in this region. Okay, with this, I stop.
Thanks for a very informative talk. Is there a simple argument to understand why the amplitude of the potential is lambda QCD to the fourth?
Yes. So you can imagine that you want to compute the mass of the axion, right? So you have what you want to compute is the effect of this coupling of the axion to QCD. So you couple two gluons, right? Let's say. And then you have some gluon blob. So each coupling of this is basically the correction to the propagator of the axion. So this basically calculates the correction to the mass of the axion. So you have two couplings here. So each coupling goes like 1 over S or 1 over B. And then all you are left is with gluons. Now, there is an argument that this type of couplings cannot produce a mass for the axion that breaks the shear symmetry at the perturbative level because these couplings are total derivatives. So the only contribution you can get from QCDs at the non-perturbative level. At the non-perturbative level, you only have one scale, which is lambda QCD. So by dimensional analysis, here you should have lambda QCD to the fourth. So this is the simplest way I know to show without equations. otherwise, I had to dig a little bit more. In fact, the lambda QCD, I mean, this is true, strictly true for Yang-Mills. In actual QCD, this actually is the pi of mass, f pi, and some function of the quarks. But parametrically, since the mass of the quarks are not that small, it's roughly the QCD scale to the 4th power.
More questions?
There was an online question that maybe I can ask here directly. So, Margarita asks, I have concluded from what you explained that a mass equal constant is not a realistic scenario. The remaining question I have is, how can one actually calculate M of T and what assumptions go into calculation? And is this dependence you described, can it be model dependent or is it general?
So I'm not sure I understand the whole question. So one question was about M of T?
Yes. So if what you've shown is...
This is a very model dependent. So it depends how... the mass of the axion is, or the mass of this phi field is generated. So in QCD, this is generated by this non-perturbative gluon dynamics. It strictly depends on whether these gluons were in terminal equilibrium that they were in the early universe, so that the mass will depend on the thermal bath of the universe at early times. Now, for more general arcs, for more general axion-like particle fields, it really depends what is the source of its mass. Could be there are scenarios where the source of the mass comes from non-perturbative effects from very high energy, so they don't know anything about the thermal bath of the standard model, so the mass will be constant, independent of the expansion of the universe. There are instead fields that are more close to the axion, in the sense that they develop their masses from the confinement of some other gauge sector. And now their dependence on the temperature really depends whether this other sector is also reheated in the early universe, if in the evolution of our universe in the past, there was a stage in which basically beside our thermal bath, there was also some abundance of some other gauge group that was produced in the past that's its own temperature and its own time dependence in the mass. But this is now it become much more model dependent.
Cool. Then let's send Giovanni again.